Thanks for clicking your way over to this bonus podcast of Speakers Forum from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. I'm your host, John O'Brien. Legendary science fiction writer Ursula K. Le Guin visited Seattle University recently to meet with students and read from her novel, The Lathe of Heaven. The work was chosen as the common text reading for SU freshmen and transfer students this year. Seattle University professor Kate Koppelman joined Le Guin in conversation. On the choice of Lathe of Heaven for the common text, she says, at its heart, it asks us to consider the relationship between self and other. Even more, our very conception of those two categories. Ursula K. Le Guin is the author of many works for children and adults. She is also an accomplished poet. She has won a National Book Award, 5 Hugo Awards, 5 Nebula Awards, and the National Book Foundation Medal, among others. She spoke at Seattle University's Campion Ballroom on October 28, 2015.
I think I'm going to stay here, actually, if that's okay. I just have a couple of things I want to say about the Common Text program and why we chose this novel, and then we will listen to Ms. Le Guin read passages from the novel and answer some questions from me, and then I'm hopeful that there'll be questions from the audience that she can answer, all right? Can everyone hear me? Is that all right? Okay. So some of you have heard me say this before in terms of why we read a common text. Reading a common text, I think, can help us reveal our uneven positioning in a world that we share in common. So our discontinuities, multiplicities, and our differences emerge in astonishing ways when we talk about a shared text. Fiction, in particular, because of its use of figurative language and its ability to manipulate chronology, seems especially adept at revealing discontinuities. And this is the first time in many years that we've read fiction as our common text. We chose this novel because we were looking for a novel that allowed multiple entry or access points for students, for faculty, and for staff. We wanted a novel that was cross-disciplinary, that invited imaginative thinking, and that resisted easy categorization or reduction to a single meaning. And I think we succeeded. So, I am honored to ask the author of this year's text to talk with us about this extraordinary novel. So thank you for being here. So I want to introduce the first passage that you're going to read a little bit by sort of saying that in some ways I think that this novel is straightforward, even though the genre sort of classifies it differently sometimes. So, and that in that it follows the development of George Orr from what you've called uncomprehended and uncomprehending to a fulfillment of sorts. He's not the only character whose perspective shifts and changes. But additionally, the novel seems to trace a kind of dance or movement between the rational and various demonstrations of the non-rational. So I thought that we could hear you read a passage that gives us, I think, George at sort of his more confused. he says, right, that he isn't right for the job of imagining a better world. So this comes from a conversation between George and Dr. Haber right after George has solved the problem of world war by creating an alien invasion. So if you have your book, it's pages 86 to 87. That's the professor and me telling everyone what pages to turn to. So,
can we open your books now?
Right, exactly.
That's more second grade, I think. But yeah. Yeah, okay, so thank you for setting it up. Dr. Haber says, you know, he's kind of trying to argue George into agreeing with him. If the aliens hadn't struck, who knows, we might actually still be fighting in the Near East. And George says, out of the frying pan, into the fire. Don't you see, Dr. Haber, that's all you ever get from me. It's not that I want to block you or frustrate your plans. Ending the war was a good idea. I agree with it totally. But I guess I can't, or my subconscious can't, even imagine a warless world. The best it can do is substitute one kind of war for another. You said no killing of humans by other humans, so I dreamed up the aliens. Your own ideas are sane and rational, but this is my unconscious you're trying to use, not my rational mind. Maybe rationally I could conceive of the human species not trying to kill each other off by nations. In fact, rationally it's easier to conceive of than the motives of war. But you're handling something outside reason. You're trying to reach progressive humanitarian goals with a tool that isn't suited to the job. Who has humanitarian dreams? Haber said nothing, showed no reaction. So Orr went on. Maybe it's not just my unconscious, irrational mind. Maybe it's my total self, my whole being, that just isn't right for the job. I'm too defeatist or passive, as you said. Maybe I don't have enough desires. Maybe that has something to do with my having this capacity to dream effectively. But if it doesn't, there might be others. But I don't want to do it. I want to get off the hook. I can't take it. I mean, look, all right, the war's been over in the Near East for 6 years. Fine. But now there are the aliens up on the moon. What if they land? What kind of monsters have you dredged up out of my unconscious mind in the name of peace? I don't even know. Well, and then Haber sort of, you know, well, nobody knows what the aliens look like, George. And he's all very reassuring and rational. And George sort of sits there. He wanted to yell at Haber, liar. Why do you lie to me? But the impulse wasn't a deep one. It led nowhere. For all he knew, Haber was incapable of sincerity because he was lying to himself. Compartmenting his mind into two hermetic halves, in one of which he knew that Orr's dreams changed reality and used them for that purpose. In the other, he knew he was using hypnotherapy and dream abreaction to treat a schizoid patient who believed that his dreams changed reality. That Haber could have got out of communication with himself was rather hard for Orr to conceive, because his own mind was so resistant to such divisions that he was slow to recognize them in others. But he had learned that they existed. He had grown up in a country run by politicians who sent the pilots to man the bombers, to kill the babies, to make the world safe for children to grow up in. But that was the old world now, not the brave new one.
Thank you. Can I ask you a couple of questions about that? So my first question for you about that has to do with George himself. Can you talk a little bit about George's middleness? His averageness, his either-or-ness.
There was a man off the street where we lived whose last name was Orr, and I thought, oh boy, that's the name I need. unfortunately, we sort of have to face the fact here that we are getting into... This book is very deeply influenced by Taoist thought. And there are only two Taoist authors, which is nice, Lao Tzu and Zhuang Tzu. But a lot of the ideas in it come from them. And we can talk about them insofar as we want to. But anyway, so George is sort of a Taoist man in that he's kind of unfinished. He's sort of ready for anything, but he is not particularly aimed in any direction, if that makes sense. There's a concept very important in Taoism, which is translated the uncarved wood. In other words, he has endless potential, but none of it is kind of finding expression until it's needed. So he is rather unusual in being extremely usual. He's just sort of like everybody.
Right, right, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think one of the questions that I, and when you read the other passages, we'll see that sort of shift, and that comparison of the uncarved wood comes up in mm-hmm. another passage as well, and I wanted to ask you about that as well, so I'm glad you mentioned that. But yeah, this one of the questions that I had about him as well was the way in which he is this sort of uncarved thing, a sort of not fully developed, and yet he's a maker. He's making all of this stuff, right? He's making new worlds. He's making new realities.
He doesn't want to.
Right. Well, and that was one of my questions for you, I think, was whether or not when I think about sort of our choice here, but also sort of things that you have said about the role of storytelling, whether you see any parallels between George as a maker and sort of novelists, poets, artists more generally.
I never thought of that. It's very clear. I wrote a lot of books, the Earthsea novels, in which the main male character is a wizard, and he really is a maker. He makes, he changes, he changes reality deliberately and intentionally. And there I see a very clear parallel with the artist, the writer or the musician, whatever. With George, I'm not sure. I'm not sure he really is a maker. He's more almost a thing made, a person to whom things happen, which is why Haber perceives him only as passive. But he isn't just passive. He is latent active. You know, one of the essential things in Taoism is you do by not doing. And it is an extremely difficult concept, which is ultimately mystical, of course. But that's what George does by not doing, and he makes by not making. So we're into paradox and mysticism at the heart of the book right away, I'm afraid.
I was going to ask you about that last, the last passage in, or the last sentence in the passage that you read, but I'm actually gonna hold that a little bit. And since we're already talking about this, if we could go to the second passage,
next.
Yeah. Okay. So the second passage that you're going to read is also about George's development. And this is where I don't know if you're going to read the passage on the uncarved wood, but.
I'm starting on 96.
Yes, that's right.
With a
little bit, yeah.
A little bit, and then skipping on a bit.
Yeah, that'd be great. But this section comes as a reflection through the character of Heather. So Heather is the one at this moment who's sort of thinking of George in these particular ways, and we start to see him differently in part because we see him through her. And I'd like us to talk about Heather as a character, as well as how she changes our sense of George, and sort of to set this up for you also, I'm interested in the way that she functions as sort of a conduit between, or a, I don't know if it's a short circuit between these two male characters.
short circuit, yeah.
Okay. In the novel. So this is if you have your books with you. Okay. So starting on 96, and I think you're jumping to page 100. So thank you.
Heather has come to find George because he stood her up. They had a date, you know, and she finds him in kind of bad shape because he's been trying to stay awake, you know. He stared at her, evidently trying to see her. "I'm sorry," he said. "I haven't been in my right mind." Saying that, he was suddenly himself again, despite his lunatic hair and eyes, a man whose personal dignity went so deep as to be nearly invisible. "It's all right," Heather says. "I don't care, but you're skipping therapy, aren't you?" He nodded. "Would you like some coffee?" he asked. It was more than dignity. Integrity, wholeness, like a block of wood, not carved. The infinite possibility, the unlimited and unqualified wholeness of being of the uncommitted, the non-acting, the uncarved, the being who, being nothing but himself, is everything. Briefly, she saw him thus, and what struck her most of that insight was his strength. He was the strongest person she'd ever known because he could not be moved away from the center.
Pure Taoism.
And a little bit later, they've been talking. And she thinks, we're kind of in Heather's viewpoint here. He never spoke with any bitterness at all, no matter how awful the things he said. Are there really people without resentment, without hate, she wondered, people who never go cross-grained to the universe, who recognize evil and resist evil and yet are utterly unaffected by it? Of course there are. Countless, the living and the dead. Those who have returned in pure compassion to the wheel. Those who follow the way that cannot be followed without knowing they follow it. The sharecropper's wife in Alabama, and the lama in Tibet, and the entomologist in Peru, and the mill worker in Odessa, and the greengrocer in London, and the goat herd in Nigeria, and the old, old man sharpening a stick by a dry stream bed somewhere on Australia, and all the others. There's not one of us who's not known them. There are enough of them, enough to keep us going, perhaps.
Thank you. Can you talk a little bit about why, at this moment in particular, these ideas are coming through Heather in the novel?
Probably because it was simply time to get out of male minds into Heather's female mind, novelistically speaking. And, of course, because Heather is the person who, the only person in the novel who perceives George for sort of what he is. Mm-hmm. Because they are falling or going to fall in love. I mean, every time they re-meet, you know, this sort of has to happen again. But yeah. I mean, there is a love story in the book.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
It's beautiful.
What's a novel without a love story?
I mean, I do think that there's some of the discussion that we've had around this novel has asked the question of or raised the issue of the fact that she's the only female character in the novel.
This novel was written in 71, and I was just learning to write as a woman, not as a man. It's the very complicated issue, and I don't want to get in deeply into it, but the fact was that literature was perceived as a male province, essentially, very strongly. Up until the 70s and 80s, when a lot of uppity feminists sort of...
did their thing. Thank God.
Move over, boys. Move over. Yeah. And particularly within science fiction. Oh, boy. I mean, it was really... it was literature for the boy engineers. So I was kind of just learning how to actually write as a woman. And not as kind of a pretend a man.
That's great. Thank you. Can you, since this is the sort of one of the passages where the Taoist influence is most clear, I think, yeah, in the novel, talk a little bit more about that generally, but also the question I think that we've talked about in emails about the title of the novel.
The title of the novel is... it's kind of all wrong. It's a quotation from a translation of Lao Tzu. an old, actually it may be the first major English translation. And let's see, it's the chapter 3. I wish I had the page 26 maybe. Let's see. Yeah, okay. And this, those whom heaven helps, we call the sons of heaven. They don't learn this by learning. They don't work it by working. They don't reason it by using reason. To let understanding stop at what cannot be understood is a high attainment. Those who cannot do it will be destroyed on the lathe of heaven. And it was such a splendid phrase, the lathe of heaven. You know. Great book title. Okay. So after the book had been out, 10, 15 years, I got a letter from a very great Chinese scholar, Joseph Needham, who said, I loved your book, but you realize that they hadn't invented lathes yet when the book was written. And this is a total mistranslation. And Burton Watson's translation of that last line is, if you don't attain this goal of understanding what cannot be understood, then heaven, the equalizer, will destroy you. Okay, well, okay, a lathe just turned, so it really wasn't even a good image. But what is the meaning of heaven, the equalizer? And here, you know, the word heaven in Chinese, this is tian. I'm saying it wrong, but that's what it, that's the best I can say it. And it is only dimly related to heaven in English. It means the sky, the celestial realm. It means nature or the nature of things. It means the law of nature or the law of the divine. I mean, it's really the nearest, when I was trying to think how to say what heaven in the title means, the nearest I can come to in language that is familiar to me is, if you know anything about Native American religions, what gets translated as the spirit or the great spirit or the spirit world or God or something, very often in Northern Native American thinking, it's very much the same thing. It means the whole everything perceived as spirit or under the aspect of spirit, if that makes any sense. Because I know you people as Catholics are much more familiar with some of this language than I am. But in a way, there's a deep unfamiliarity here probably to some of you in this concept of what heaven could mean. But it is that which makes it all come out right, makes it equalizes. It's yin and yang, if you know those terms. It's their endless interplay, which never favors one or the other.
Thank you. Since we're talking about nature, I'll have that be the segue into the last passage, where we, one of the questions I had about the last passage was for you to talk a little bit about the use of figurative language in the novel as a whole, so metaphor just as a figure. And you talked about the George as a block of wood. Heather gets compared to a black widow spider early in the novel.
She compares herself to a black
widow
spider.
Right, she does. She does. The clicking, right. But the image with which the novel begins and ends is the image of the sea, the vastness of the sea. You have the jellyfish at the beginning and you have the turtles at the end. So maybe we can just hear you read from that, and that would be the... We can open to questions after that. That would be great.
Okay.
I didn't give people page numbers. 177.
Yeah, this, I won't read most of that, so we don't go on too long with it. This is after the sort of climactic event of the novel, and George has interfered with Haber's dreaming. And things have kind of fallen to pieces to a large extent. And it's kind of like the suburbs of chaos, he calls it. And he meets up with an alien, and it took him to its apartment near the river, over a bicycle repair shop, next door to the Hope Eternal Gospel Mission, which was pretty full tonight. All over the world, the various gods were being requested more or less politely for an explanation of what had occurred between 6:25 and 7:08 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. Sweetly discordant Rock of Ages rang underfoot as they climbed dark stairs to a second-story flat. The alien suggested that George lie down on the bed as he looked tired. Sleep that knits up the raveled sleeve of care, it said. To sleep, perchance to dream, aye, there's the rub, Orr replied. There was, he thought, something in the curious manner in which the aliens communicated, but he was much too tired to decide what. Where will you sleep? He inquired, sitting down heavily on the bed. Nowhere, the alien replied, its toneless voice dividing the word into two equally significant holes. Orr stooped to unlace his shoes. He didn't want to get the alien's bedspread dirty with his shoes. That would be scarcely a fair return for kindness. Stooping made him dizzy. I'm tired, he said. I did a lot today. That is, I did something. The only thing I've ever done. I pressed a button. It took the entire willpower, the accumulated strength of my entire existence to press one damn off button. You have lived well, the alien said. It was standing in a corner, apparently intending to stand there indefinitely. It wasn't standing there, Orr thought, not in the same way that he would stand or sit or lie or be. It was standing there in the way that he in a dream might be standing. It was there in the sense that in a dream one is somewhere. He lay back. He clearly sensed the pity and protective compassion of the alien standing across the dark room. It saw him, not with eyes, as short-lived, fleshly, armorless, a strange creature, infinitely vulnerable, adrift in the gulfs of the possible, something that needed help. He didn't mind. He did need help. Weariness took him over, picked him up like a current of the sea into which he was sinking slowly. Er perenne, he muttered, surrendering to sleep. Er perenne, replied Enemnem Asfa soundlessly. Orr slept. He dreamed. There was no rub. His dreams, like waves of the deep sea far from any shore, came and went, rose and fell, profound and harmless, breaking nowhere, changing nothing. They danced the dance among all the other waves in the sea of being. Through his sleep, the great green sea turtles dived, swimming with heavy, inexhaustible grace through the depths in their element.
Thank you.
Okay, Kate has been asking a lot of questions, and now it's time for questions from you all. So we have two microphones, one at each aisle, and I'd invite you to come up to a microphone and share your question. We have a lot of people in the room, and I would imagine we have a lot of questions. So I will ask you to ask one question. Maybe you've been saving up since you were eight, like me, but one question would be great. So I'll invite you all to come up and ask your questions.
Somebody be brave. We can talk about anything.
Great. We have our first question over here to your right.
Hello.
Yeah. It's on. It's on.
Just curious. 35 years since you originally wrote this book, other than the language, which obviously you would change, would you change anything significant about the series of events, or would you more or less leave it the same, albeit with change in language?
I wouldn't change the language so much as some of the misforecasts. It's just amazing how you know, science fiction all is supposed to be about the future. We didn't know. We didn't have a clue about the future. You may have noticed the absence of computers. little things like that, you know. But also the absence of automobiles. I honestly believed back in 1970 that by 2002 or whenever this was supposed to be, that we would have got over the automobile. But that you're, as you no, the I think the sequence of events. The book was kind of, I just let George dream the dreams. I don't feel that I controlled the book very much writing it in that sense, and so I probably wouldn't change that if I wrote it again now. If that answers your question.
Thank you. Take a question from over here.
I just want to say, first of all, I love the language and the grace of your writing in this book. That was amazing. I have a question about George, more as a character in a novel. I really loved his general neutrality and middleness. I found it made him easy to connect to kind of, you know, imprint yourself on him as the reader. But some of my friends wish that he was more, I don't know, consciously impactful on the plot. Was that a debate with you, with him as a character, in whether he would be connectable or forgettable as the main character?
Huh. I don't think I really considered it in those terms. I realized that he might strike some people as awfully wishy-washy. And, you know, kind of hard to identify with as particularly maybe for guys, as a main character. Because he behaves very passively, and I sort of wondered, but he kind of had to be that way, so I guess it wasn't much of a debate for me.
Thank you.
What advice would you give to a young writer trying to get his or her name out there right now?
Be patient. To a young writer, I really have to say, don't worry so much about getting your name out there. Worry about writing what you have in you to write and doing it right. Because that's what gets the name out there for good, is doing good work, you know. And there's a lot to learn about writing. There really is an awful lot to learn. It'll take a while. Good luck.
Hey, I really admire your work. Thank you for coming today. When I first read this book, actually, as a teenager, it struck me how this book, more than I think your other works, it really reminded me of, like, Philip K. Dick, particularly, I guess, the protagonist. Okay, you're nodding. I was going to ask, like, do you see that influence? And I guess, like...
Oh, yeah, it's almost like a homage to Philip K. Dick. Yeah.
Okay. So that was, like, a deliberate, like, action, I guess, or... I guess,
yeah,
like...
What... He taught me some things about what to... some things to write about and kind of how to go at it. So I was happily imitating him.
Okay, awesome. Thank you.
It's not here.
Okay, I think it's on now. Or not?
Maybe you need to pick it out and hold it.
Yes.
Okay, so you guys can hear me now?
Yeah.
So after convocation, we had, like, discussions about the book, what's interesting is that, like, we raised this question about what you meant by something, and it's, like, so amazing to get to ask you that question in person. So thank you for coming. I don't remember what page it's on. Also, I don't have the book, sorry. But on a page, it talks about when Heather loses color, and about how George starts to talk about the value of that, about her appearance and her personality. And it's interesting, he associates her with Baltic Amber and Ceylon Tea. And I was wondering, like, it was calling her a bunch of different things. It was calling her dark and clear and angry and kind and a bunch of antitheses to describe how beautiful she was. But I was wondering, was the allusion to Ceylon Tea and Baltic Amber, which are, like, harvested, taken from, and part of, like, a result of colonization, was that, like, intentional word choice to kind of show how, on the surface, he might be appreciating her, but also maybe exoticizing her?
No, I think... I was much more naive than that.
Okay.
I think Baltic Amber because it's dark brown rather than pale as we think of most amber. And tea because I was simply describing what color Heather is. And the fact that those are colonial products. Of course, they were pre-colonial. There was tea before the whites came in. Started using it, you know. But anyway, no, I have no such complexities in my thought, I'm afraid.
Well, it's interesting to find out.
Yeah, sure. Good question.
Hi, I wanted to start out by thanking you. I've been a fan of yours since I was a kid. So you've talked about in interviews how you transitioned from writing as a man to writing as a woman. What does that mean to you?
It meant that I could go on writing. It really, to put it in briefly. I was beginning to kind of run dry as a writer, and I didn't know what was wrong until I realized that I've been kind of writing like I was a man, and I'm not. And all these feminists have been lurking around here giving me permission to write as a woman, and I better start learning how to do it, or I won't ever write again. So that's that. I hope that answers the question.
Thank you.
Amanda.
Hi. Thank you so much for coming here. I wanted to ask you... Monica, you're the best.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you, when I first started reading science fiction, you were one of the first writers to really show diversity in your characters, you know, Ged and Genli Ai and Heather and Lathe of Heaven. And I feel like even now we still have so much work to do. Do you think we'll ever get there?
Well, we're a lot closer than we were when I started. I mean, I know, both with the whole race problem and with the whole feminist problem. But we have made some progress, and we just have to keep on pushing, right?
Thank you very much.
Sure.
Thank you for your time today. Is there any aspect of fiction writing in particular you feel your generation possesses that mine may be lacking?
Well, we're older. all that comes to mind in a sense is that, because, you know, everybody has to reinvent the wheel in the arts, always. But I think, difficult as it was to get published in my generation, it's tougher. Things about it as tough as it's ever been to actually think of making a career as a writer now. It really is very, things are in such chaos and confusion in the whole publishing world. Obviously, we just somehow hope that the internet will change it in a good way, but we have to be able to, the writer has to be able to buy peanut butter, right? And that's kind of what's breaking down, is the ways to get the peanut butter coming. It's getting really, really tough. So, again, I have to say good luck.
Thank you, ma'am.
I'm a high school English teacher, and I love teaching your work to my students, and they love reading it because they feel like, I don't know, it's just, it's wonderfully creative, and it opens their minds in some ways that the other books that we read in high school typically don't. And so they've read this year The Left Hand of Darkness, and then, that was required by me, and then a few of them chose to read the Word for World is Forest, and then they asked me, because I knew I was coming, to ask you if you could recommend the next book by you that they should read.
Yeah, okay. How old are they?
They're 17, 18. Seniors.
The Dispossessed.
Oh, you know what? I just finished that. They'll love it. Good idea. Thank you so much. And they thank you, too.
Hello. So my English class wanted to collectively ask you, which character's viewpoint do you connect to most? George Orr's more average or neutral view of our purpose, or Haber's view of trying to actively change the world?
I thought that was fairly clear for the, in the book. But I don't think I want as an author to say where I stand, but I would ask them to if they think that, I mean, to ask that question means that they think maybe George has unfairly stopped Haber from doing good. You ask them that question. Do you believe?
Okay. Thank you.
Hello, my name is Tessa McDowell, and I am a seventh grader at a middle school in Federal Way, and my question is, what made you want to write in the science fiction genre as opposed to other genres? What made you, like, really...
Choose that?
Yeah, choose that instead of other ones.
You know, it was kind of by chance. I've been writing... I wrote all my life, but I couldn't sell anything except some poems. I couldn't get anything into print for years. And I kept sending stories out, and they kept coming back. And in 1 week, a little literary magazine accepted a kind of literary story, and a science fiction magazine accepted a science fiction or fantasy story. And the literary magazine gave me 2 copies of the magazine. And the science fiction magazine gave me $30. And we really needed the $30 back then. We really did. And so I, hey, okay, they're going to pay me. I'm going to write more of this stuff. It's a little more complicated than that. But.
Thank you. Hi, I'm sort of as a spokesperson for my friend who couldn't make it tonight and was really sad about it. He says, I'm hugely impressed with your ability to pack these epic stories into approachable-sized books. Wizards of Earthsea did basically all of Harry Potter in a handful of chapters. what advice do you have for writers trying to emulate this way of storytelling?
Oh, yeah. Oh, dear. I really don't know how to answer a question, because the idea of being emulated is kind of scary and, I don't know. And yet, having emulated many authors myself, you know, that is the way to start. You just read stuff you like and try to do something like it. And there's, you know, that's not plagiarizing. You're not imitating, literally. You're just trying to do something like that. And I think it's this combination of reading and then trying to write that way. Oh, goodness, I tried so hard to write like D.H. Lawrence. Oh, it was awful. You know. But you learn even when it flops. So again, just stick with it. And of course, what's happening is your friend is actually looking for their own voice. You can only find it by writing.
Hi, first of all, I just wanted to say thank you for writing the books that you've written, because I feel they've made me a more intelligent and a more compassionate person, and that's quite important to me. And I reckon probably a lot of people here would agree. The question that I would like to ask you is, The Lathe of Heaven is a book about someone who brings profound change and they don't mean to. And I feel that's often a theme in a lot of your work, that people or cultures meet and they change each other, whether they mean to or not. And I wondered if you think that's something that we can help doing, and if our intentions, whether they're good or bad, make any difference, or whether it's just our ideas or who we are.
Whoa.
I'm sorry. That might be a bit...
Large question. Yeah.
It felt like your body of work to me.
I think you definitely have something I hadn't thought about, is that I do... I often... throw my characters into a situation where they sort of have to change things and be changed. But of course, that is simply storytelling. A story is about a change, about something that changes. A story is, it starts, it ends up somewhere other than where it starts. Or it may end up back where it started, but things have happened along the way, you know. So that's simply inherent in storytelling. But perhaps the fact that my father was an anthropologist, I was more aware than many Americans of the impact of one culture upon another, you know, that somehow got deep into me early on. I don't know. But that's about it, all I can really do by way of answer.
I think that makes sense. Thank you.
Sure.
Again, thank you for being here with us today to answer our questions. And my question, you kind of touched on it a little bit earlier when you said that you knew a man living up the street by the last name of Orr. And I was curious whether or not the author of 1984, George Orwell, was of any influence on the name.
Probably unconsciously. But not if I'd been conscious of it, I might have avoided it.
Yeah.
But I just like George Orr. And this was long, long before George Orr appeared in whatever television series that was, you know. So, it sounded sort of silly, George Orr. I liked it.
All right, thank you.
Sure. That one was easy.
Hi. Thank you so much for coming. I really enjoyed reading your book. The one thing that really bothered me reading the book was your treatment of Heather as a mixed race person. And when suddenly everyone is gray, she disappears. And as like a mixed race person myself, that really hurt. I don't think that that's the only thing that creates individuals. But I was wondering about how you saw that as one of the most important aspects. Why, for instance... do you think that there's a difference between culture and race, that everyone wouldn't disappear?
No. I was rereading that passage where George is thinking why Heather is not in the gray world, and his interpretation is that her color is so essential to her that she, without it, she couldn't be Heather, which I began. I was thinking, why does George think that? You are making the assumption that a novelist understands their own thought processes. And so here I am asking my own character, George, why did you not even expect to find Heather, as it were, in the among the gray people? He couldn't imagine her being gray. But you know, you have to ask, could she imagine him being gray instead of white? So I simply do not know the answer to your question. It's a very good question, and it's one of those. I'm not sure any of us, even now, could answer, but maybe we'll get to the point where we can answer that question. I hope so. Yeah. Thank you.
Hi. So I really only started looking at your stuff this year. It's kind of bad of me, but you've been on my to-read list for a while. But so I noticed, like, you kind of take a really interesting approach to, like, sci-fi. Like, I noticed a lot of sci-fi goes into, like, great detail about, I don't know, like, engineering or, like, a new alien species or, you know, something like that. But you leave, like, a lot of mystery in your stories. So I'm just kind of curious, like, what does sci-fi kind of mean to you as a subject? Because it seems really different from, like, a lot of other stuff I read.
Yeah, well, to me, science fiction and fantasy are... Science fiction is kind of a branch of fantasy. And, in other words, imaginative literature, whatever you want to call it. Non-realistic fiction. And science fiction is just a particular way of writing that, which can be a really satisfying and interesting way of doing it. And it's a fairly recent one, after all. Fantasy's been around as long as human beings have, I think. But science fiction is, you know, less... 100 years or so, or since Mary Shelley, or whatever. And it was just a lot of fun to learn how to do it. But I can't do math, and I admire engineers, but I don't know any engineering, so I tend to play more with psychology and culture as my sciences in science fiction.
Thank you.
Sure.
Hi. So you cover a lot of different topics in your writing, and a lot of them translate to societal issues that we encounter today. And so I was kind of just wondering if you had any advice for our generation and for future generations as we move forward in this world and, like, taking care of the planet.
Take care of the planet. Good luck doing that. Hang in there. Yeah. Boy, what a mess we're handing you. I don't feel, in a way, that anybody my age, my generation, has any right to give any advice. I wrote this book in 1971. We knew the scientists were telling us back then, the book is full of, you know, global warming and all that sort of stuff, climate. We knew, and we didn't do anything about it. And now people are sort of saying, oh, gee, yeah. Maybe we should listen to the scientists. Listen to the scientists, okay?
Thank you for being here today and taking questions. I write in science fiction and fantasy, and a lot of the time in academic settings, there can be a bit of a kickback against genre fiction as opposed to literary fiction. And so I was just wondering, for you, why do we need science fiction?
Oh, well, why do we need any fiction? Yeah. Yeah. There are a lot of people who say we don't need any fiction. They just make things up, you know. We need science fiction along with all other arts and all the imaginative arts because we need to cultivate our imagination. Because without imagination, well, for one thing, you don't have any science or engineering. Right there. You're making something. You're foreseeing something. You're planning something. You're using your imagination, and science fiction can be very good imaginative training. So that's one reason.
Thank you.
Hi there. I'm wondering if there has ever been a topic that has been too provocative for you to publish, and if so, what would it be?
Well, I don't remember ever being afraid of tackling something, because I get into trouble. Uh, But there are probably things that I'd just be scared of. You know, just putting my foot wrong or getting it wrong. Yeah, you don't want to do that in public.
Hi, I'm wondering if you could speak more to the mystical paradox that you mentioned of that you do by not doing. I haven't read The Lethe of Heaven, but I just read The Ones Who Walk Away from Omelas, and I thought, even there, I was having a discussion with a friend about what it meant, and that there's some people who stay and some people who leave, and even the ones who leave aren't helping directly the child, the it, in the basement. And I'm hearing a lot of words about the character of George as kind of an average or middle, but I feel like somewhere in the Taoist concept, the mystical paradox, there's something greater coming from that, and I'm interested.
When Heather said in the little passage I read that he is the strongest person she'd ever met, she realizes that this apparent averageness is, in a way, not so. Yeah. It's such a huge subject. And getting off on the whole, when to walk away from Omelas, you know, take us elsewhere. I would just say, read, when you can read my version of it or anybody else's, read Lao Tzu. It's only like 40 pages. It was written 3,000 years ago in China. It is one of the basic human texts, I think, for anybody who's interested in spirituality, ethical thinking, and so on. Read Lao Tzu.
Is there a translation you would recommend?
Well, mine.
Oh, yours. Oh, I'm sorry, right.
It's not really a translation. It's a version. I worked with a Chinese scholar. But there's lots of good ones. Arthur Whaley is one of the great ones. He's very political. I'm more spiritual. But,
yeah. I'll take a look at yours. Thank you.
Hi, I know there are many young writers in the room, and as a young writer, I was wondering, how do you schedule your writing? How do you make the time to put the words on the page?
Well, that was only a really intense question when I had three kids at home. And then I did it after 10 at night. If you're an artist and you really want to work at your art, you have to find the time. And if you, as a student, I could write, because, well, for one thing, you can stay awake later than older people can. You can work all night, you know, and so on. But if you got a 9-to-5 job, it's very, very hard to practice any art. And writing is a fairly slow art, unless you write a lot of flash fiction or short stories or poems or something. If you've got a novel to write, it can take years. And fitting that in with the rest of life is tough. So, there's no answer to your question, but just realize that if you're serious about your writing, it's going to require time and a place to do it, which probably means some kind of jerk work to live on, you know, because you probably can't live off it, if ever, not for a long time. I just sponged off my husband for years.